Dinah Lance is a fighter, and her one-woman war is against the czars of crime, the frightened men who dread the blonde bombshell, otherwise known as Black Canary.
Welcome back to Flowers and Fishnets, a Black Canary podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, here to tell you that you can like Supergirl or you can like Jessica Jones, but you can't like both. That's how fandom works, damn it. Okay, I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving and a wonderful Black Friday. I hope you dined well on Thursday and trampled some strangers on Friday, because that's what the holidays are all about. What's on the docket for this episode? A couple of things, actually. Really exciting things. First, and this is the only real bad news, is I will not be reviewing issue 6 of the current Black Canary comic from Brendan Fletcher and Annie Wu. Why not? Because it hasn't come out yet. For whatever reason, the issue missed its deadline and did not ship in the month of November. Will it double ship in December to make up for the lost time? I don't know. I hope so. I'm really looking forward to how Fletcher concludes this first story arc and where things go after that with the mysterious White Ninja. So, what comic am I reviewing today? Well, don't get confused when I say Black Canary issue 8. I'm going back to 1993 and the original Black Canary ongoing series that I started reviewing when this podcast first launched back in February. The series only lasted 12 issues. I've already reviewed the first 7, and I want to finish the last 5 before the end of this calendar year. The next bit of business is Darren and Ruth Sutherland, better known as my new favorite people in the world. You've heard me talk about Darren and Ruth before. They're friends of the show. They also host a Trekker Talk podcast, which covers the Trekker comic created by writer and artist Ron Randall. Well, earlier this week, Darren and Ruth started another podcast called Warlord Worlds. This show is a love letter to Mike Grell. They're going to review his work on Warlord, Star Slayer, John Sable, and, most importantly for my purposes, Green Arrow. Now, I was actually going to start covering Grell's Green Arrow on this show starting next year, and actually make Green Arrow a bigger part of this podcast on a regular basis. But the only stories I really wanted to cover was that Mike Grell run, and I think the Sutherlands are going to do a great job with that. So the Fishnets podcast is going to take a different turn in the future. I'll tell you more about that some other time. But staying on the subject of the Sutherlands, you may recall that on a previous episode I thanked them for sending me a copy of Green Arrow, The Longbow Hunters, signed by Mike Grell. Well, last week they sent me another all-too-generous gift that they picked up at a recent convention. This is a signed Black Canary print by none other than Neil Adams. It's beautiful, and I'm so thankful for Darren and Ruth's gift. Any list of the top 3 best Black Canary artists has to include Neil Adams, and I'm so happy to have this in my collection. I'll make sure to post the image on the blog for this episode. Which brings me to the last bit of business for this show, and it's staying in the same realm of gift-giving and the holiday spirit. Since I've started podcasting, which has only been this year, hard to imagine between my 3.5 shows that I've done like 75 episodes this year, but since I started, I have made a lot of great friends, people I respect, admire, and care about. I've also received some very nice goodies from other podcasters and fans besides the Sutherlands. Michael Bradley from the Superman and Batman podcast sent me a copy of Showcase Presents World's Finest Volume 1. Twitter user Shazam Billy Batson sent me a copy of the Jeff Smith book Billy Batson and the Magic of Shazam. And of course, Dr. Ange and the Irredeemable Shag each gave me some sweet Black Canary merchandise they scored at comic conventions over the summer. In that spirit, I am going to send out a gift of my own to some lucky listener of this podcast. You can receive a free copy of Black Canary and Zatanna Bloodspell, the softcover graphic novel by Paul Dini and Joe Quinones. All you need to do to be entered for your chance to win is leave a comment on this episode on the blogger comments section, or tweet about or retweet this podcast on Twitter. Do that, and your name will be entered into the drawing, and the winner will be chosen at random on December 12th. Sound good? Okay, I'm going to play some promos, and after the break, my review of Black Canary Issue 8 from 1993. Don't go away.
Trekker Talk, a fan podcast devoted to the adventures of 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the pages of Trekker Comics by creator, writer, and artist Ron Randall. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. We'll be discussing the stories, characters, and art in this excellent retro sci-fi adventure series, as well as having side conversations about other areas of fandom.
We hope you'll join us as we travel from the dangerous backstreets of New Gallif to the depths of outer space and everywhere in between.
Trekker Talk is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Who here likes comic books? Who likes superheroes? Who likes superhero comic books? From the 90s! That's what I thought. Hey there. I'm Nathaniel Wayne from the Council of Geeks, and though I've always loved superheroes, the only time I was buying monthly issues was during the much maligned 1990s. I've decided to go through my personal collection, issue by issue, and in my own little way, try to answer the question, were 90s comics really that bad? Chances are the answer will be yes, but I think these books deserve another chance, and they're going to get it. On 90s Comics Retrial, part of the Council of Geeks podcast, available on iTunes and at 90scomicsretrial.wordpress.com.
Black Canary Issue 8 is titled The Fish, and it's written by James Owsley, illustrated by James Hodgkins, colored by Julia Lachman, lettered by Steve Haney, and edited by Jordan Garfinkel and Dennis O'Neill. Notice that this is quite a different creative team. The first seven issues were written by Sarah Byam, penciled by Trevor Von Eden, and edited by Mike Gold. At this point, Jordan Garfinkel took over the editing, with Denny O'Neill supervising. The most notable difference, though, is the new writer and artist. Unfortunately, they're only around for this one fill-in issue. The cover was still drawn by regular series artist Trevor Von Eden. It depicts Black Canary on a rooftop, surprised as the relatively new superhero called The Ray blasts some gun-toting hoods with his energy blasts. There is a text piece on the cover in the shape of an arrow pointing to The Ray, and it says, "There's a new man in Dinah's life, The Ray." The issue was cover dated August 1993, but according to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics, would have hit comic shops on June 22nd that year. When the story opens, Black Canary has come to Philadelphia, tracking a material witness from Seattle. Her target is a man named Freddy, who cooked the books for a mob boss named Tony the Fish, and who is scheduled to testify against the Fish in court in 48 hours. Dinah is already jet-lagged from chasing Freddy from one coast to the other, but what bothers her even more this night is a painful bout of menstrual cramps. Spotting Freddy's rental car, Black Canary does the urban vigilante thing of running over the roof of a city bus, leaping off of taxicabs, you know, the same type of thing Spider-Man and Daredevil do, only those guys don't typically wear stiletto heels. She leaps and flips and crashes her booted feet through the windshield of Freddy's car, causing him to crash into a fruit stand. She drags him out of the car, him and the ledger he came all the way to Philadelphia to get. Dinah knows the situation. The ledger could put Tony the Fish in jail forever, so the boss threatened Freddy's family if he didn't give the evidence back to the mob. But now that Freddy has retrieved the ledger, he and anyone around him are expendable. Dinah figures that out just before a pair of the Fish's hired gunmen try to blow her and Freddy away. Black Canary disarms them with some expertly thrown pieces of fruit from the stand, followed by some judo kicks and punches. She grabs Freddy and the ledger and runs down an alley. But when she looks around the corner to see if it's secure, Freddy knocks her upside the head with a liquor bottle. He puts some kind of pill in her mouth, some knockout drug, and then runs for his life, leaving her alone in the dark alley. An uncertain amount of time passes, wherein the dark alley seems to get darker, before all of a sudden the area is lit up by the radiant light of Happy Terrell, better known as the 1940s superhero called the Ray. Cut to Veterans Stadium, the former home field for the Philadelphia Phillies baseball team and the Eagles football team, and a stadium that sadly no longer exists, but was the stadium for the City of Brotherly Love at the time this issue was written and drawn. Inside, Happy Terrell's 18-year-old son, Ray, who recently became the new The Ray in a miniseries written by James Owsley, is working as a vendor selling ice cream and other cold treats for the spectators. Ray is not especially happy with his job, but it's the only type of employment he's been able to land since he spent the first 18 years of his life convinced that direct sunlight would kill him. This, of course, was a lie perpetrated by his father to protect him from the truth, that the sunlight actually fuels his metahuman light-based powers. Ray spots his girlfriend Jenny at the ballpark with another boy and jealously confronts her. Already making an ass of himself, Ray is interrupted by the sudden appearance of the original Ray, who summons Lil Ray. The old and new Rays take off, flying on beams of light energy until they reach the alley where Black Canary is still unconscious. Happy tells his son that he knew Black Canary's mother and he wants him to take good care of her. Ray brings Dinah back to his crappy little apartment. When the knockout drug wears off, Dinah wakes up in Ray's bed wearing one of his t-shirts, not her costume or wig. She remembers about Freddy and calls Oliver Queen, but gets the answering machine. She leaves Ali a message telling him that if Freddy isn't dead yet, he's probably heading back to Seattle to turn his ledger over to Tony the Fish. At that point, Ray's cousin Hank comes over to brag about how cool he is and how many girls he dates. That's when he sees Dinah ask if she can use Ray's shower and makes the conclusion that cousin Ray lost his virginity. Hank might have chosen his words better because at that same moment, Jenny comes over to apologize to Ray, only to find Dinah in his apartment wearing nothing but a bath towel. Jenny storms off, Ray goes to apologize, Hank falls down laughing, and Dinah takes a shower. After that, she gathers her costume, which smells like the dumpster she lay next to for half the night. She tells Ray she needs to get to the airport and get back to Seattle and that she's already extremely late. Well, Ray can do better than drive her to the airport. He switches on his powers and costume and becomes the Ray once more, picking Dinah up and carrying her across the country at light speed. They arrive at Dinah's home above her flower shop, Sherwood Florist, to find Oliver Queen asleep in her bed. Dinah's furious about this. They broke up, which I'm assuming happened in a relatively recent issue of Green Arrow, since they were still together back in issue 5, if I remember correctly. Ali says he was worried about her chasing Freddy and taking on Tony the Fish. Dinah says he had no right to enter her home and sleep in her bed. When Ali notices the Ray there, he becomes jealous that Dinah has already picked up a new boyfriend, and a teenager, no less. Dinah doesn't correct Ali's mistake, she just kicks him out of her place. Dinah changes back into Black Canary costume, perhaps she has a spare or maybe she washed her clothes first, and tells Ray thanks, but she's got a job to do. She stakes out the Fish's building for 8 hours, waiting for Freddy to show up. When he eventually does, the Fish's men have spotted Black Canary on the rooftop and surrounded her with guns pointed. This was all according to her plan, but the plan goes awry when the Ray decides to play hero and shows up blasting the Fish's men. I'm not exactly sure what her plan was or why she needed the men to be surrounding her, but somehow the Ray screws this up. Ray attacks the Fish's goons in an attempt to impress Black Canary, who he's developed a little crush on, understandably so, but he lets Freddy escape. Dinah tells him she knows he tried to help, but he screwed up, and he's got to let her do her job alone. Dinah goes back to Sherwood Florist to blow off some steam by working. Ali shows up with a box of chocolates and tries to apologize for his behavior, but Dinah doesn't believe in his concern, only his jealousy. She tells him to get lost, but he tells her that he did a little snooping and found out that Freddy is meeting with the Fish at the fairgrounds that night to turn over the ledger. Black Canary goes to the meeting place to catch Freddy. She spots him just as he's about to turn over the book to Tony the Fish. When she calls out to him, Tony draws a gun, but Ollie followed Dinah in his Green Arrow garb and disarms the fish with an arrow shot to his hand. Bad news is, the fish anticipated trouble and has not one but two helicopters on the scene with men shooting at Black Canary and Green Arrow. Ollie takes out one of the helicopter gunmen while Dinah beats up some of the men trying to grab Freddy. And then, somewhat predictably, the Ray comes back and takes down both helicopters with his light energy powers. Ray says he couldn't leave Black Canary in danger, no matter what she asked him to do. With the threat neutralized, Green Arrow shows his jealousy again, saying Black Canary has to choose between him and the Ray, even though she already broke up with him before. The boys puff their chests in a show of machismo. Black Canary grabs Green Arrow and plants a long kiss on him that lasts three panels, long enough for Ray to feel uncomfortable and foolish and send him flying back to Philadelphia to try to reconcile with Jenny. Of course, all Dinah wanted was to send Ray home. Once that's done, she tells Ollie how she really feels about him, by knocking him on his ass and walking off. Okay, it's taken me a long enough time to get to this review. When I started covering this series, I was equal parts anticipating and dreading this issue. I wanted to talk about it because it is far and away the best issue of the series. I mean, I can't be any gentler than saying the Black Canary's first ongoing series sucked. Go back to the earlier episodes and you will hear me tear apart the writing as amateurish and the art as plain old ugly. But we finally got fresh blood on the book. I don't know a lot about James Hodgkins, the artist of this issue. This was only his second professional work, according to Mike's Amazing World. He did some other scattered work for DC, including some issues of Detective Comics and Catwoman that I don't think I ever read. But that doesn't really matter. What matters is that he's not Trevor Von Eden. Hodgkins' work in this issue is not revolutionary, it's merely pretty good, but when you compare it to how the series has looked before, you want to give the guy an award. His women look like women, and that's the best part about the art, and something that I couldn't say about Trevor Von Eden. And by the way, you're going to hear me trash Von Eden until the end of this series, and I'm not going to pull my punches very often, but I also want it known that the guy could draw once upon a time. In fact, I'm eventually going to get to some of his work with Dinah and Ollie in World's Finest. That looks great. I mean, the guy created Count Vertigo. I can't wait to review that story. But I'm not talking about Trevor Von Eden anymore this episode, and I don't really have a whole lot more to say about James Hodgkins. Like I said, the art is pretty good. From the first page, Black Canary looks like a woman. Okay, a Japanese woman. There's something going on with her eyes that looks faintly ethnic. His version of Ray Taro looks young, and his version of Oliver Queen looks old. Maybe too old, but it's a nice contrast. The action scenes are generally easy to follow, and there are a few panels where bodies are completely blacked out or silhouetted during action. I always assumed the colorist Julia Lachman did that to cover up for Von Eden's crappy pencils, but maybe that's her style and approach. It was 1993, after all. The more significant difference in this issue, though, is the writing by James Owsley. Now, it's possible you've never heard of James Owsley before, but you may have heard of a guy named Christopher Priest. It's the same guy. He changed his name a couple months after this issue was published. Owsley, when he was still named Owsley, worked as a writer and editor for DC and Marvel. Up to this point, his biggest critical success was reviving the Golden Age property, The Ray, for a new generation, in a miniseries that also launched the career of artist Joe Quesada, who would go on to become editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics only about a decade later. It's clear from this issue of Black Canary that Owsley wanted to keep Ray Terrell in use until he could secure the ongoing series that would start in 1994, and in which Black Canary would guest star for about six issues. But before the ongoing Ray series started, Owsley changed his name to Christopher Priest. He's sometimes credited as just Priest. In the late 90s, early 2000s, he wrote an incredible run on Black Panther from Marvel, one of the best comics I've ever read, and one of the reasons T'Challa is among my favorite Marvel superheroes. Priest also wrote a novel called The Prestige, which was loosely, very loosely, adapted into a film by Christopher Nolan starring Batman and Wolverine. I knew all of that going into this issue, so I knew it would be head and shoulders better than the previous Black Canary comics. And it is. It's not perfect, but it's better than what we've had. There are some clunky moments, some cringe-inducing dialogue. When Ali goes back to Sherwood Forest to apologize to Dinah, she tells him, "Stop insulting me, Ali. Your junior varsity chest beating strips me of my humanity and reduces me to less than a person, to less than a name." Up until that line, Owsley's dialogue and narration had been very natural, very casual. It sounded great. It was fun to read. But that line just stopped the story dead. No one would ever speak like that. That's the kind of sentence you'd find in an essay on feminism, not something a woman would say when she's fighting with her boyfriend. It's too smart, too articulate, too poetic for the scene. It also reminds me why I hate Green Arrow and Black Canary as a couple sometimes. Mike Grell's run on Green Arrow is my favorite version of that character, but it is also my least favorite interpretation of Black Canary. This whole era was extremely rough for Ali and Dinah because Ali has always been socially progressive, if not a bleeding heart liberal. But at the same time, he has always treated Dinah like a girl who needs guidance and protection. Maybe it's because Grell's series accentuated the 20-year age gap between them, but Ali doesn't treat Dinah like she's an independent woman or a competent fighter. He's very conservative, very old-fashioned when it comes to their relationship. And the result is that Green Arrow frequently comes across as a hypocrite and a jerk, and Black Canary comes across as bitchy when she points it out. This is one of the reasons why I prefer Black Canary with someone like Starman or even the Ray. Speaking of which, yeah, this issue is very much a backdoor pilot for the Ray's ongoing series. It's clear that Owsley really wanted to write more of the Ray and his supporting cast because they come across as much more fun and genuine and likable, even in their teenage angst, than Dinah and Ali. The Ray part of the story is the best part of this issue, unfortunately. And eventually, I'll get to covering the Ray ongoing series that Black Canary guested in. It's one of my favorite DC comics from the 90s. You'll hear more about that in time. Something else that Owsley brings to attention is the impracticality of Dinah's costume in this issue. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's coming down from editor Denny O'Neill's desk, because it seems like he really wanted to change Black Canary's look. And that will happen in the next couple of issues. The last thing about this story I want to mention is the ending. The whole story is leading up to Black Canary using Freddy to bring down the fish. Along the way, she keeps butting heads with the Ray and Green Arrow. She doesn't want their help. She wants to do this alone. This is her job. But she doesn't do it alone. Can't, in fact. She's foiled a number of times, and were it not for Green Arrow and the Ray's involvement at the end, she would probably be dead. Freddy certainly would be. That frustrates her by the end of the story, that the men screwed up her job by competing for her attention. It objectifies her. The real problem is there's no commentary on this, no ironic wink at the reader. It just is. Black Canary couldn't do the job alone. She needed the men to step in and save her, and they did that just for the chance to sleep with her. And she hates it. I hate it too, because there's no other subliminal context. It's just what it is. She worked real hard for something, and then some men swooped in and finished the job for her and gave her a patronizing look like they're all back in the 1950s. It's just really unsatisfying ending on every level. Which sucks, because at this point I'm used to that with this series, but I really thought Owsley would give me some room for optimism. And that brings me to the reason I was dreading this review. This issue wasn't perfect, like I said, especially the ending, but damn if it wasn't the best issue of the series. In truth, it's the only beam of light in the whole series. There are four more issues after this, and they suck. It's all downhill from here, but I'm going to try and review them all in December. I'll probably do issues 9, 10, and 11 all at once, since it's a three-part story, guest starring Nightwing and the Huntress, and then issue 12 and a series overview to wrap things up. Okay, some listener feedback. Episode 18, which covered Black Canary issue 5 of the current series, received a couple of comments on the blog page. Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary said, "Agree, this was another good issue. For me, DCU has been a success, as Martian Manhunter, Starfire, and Black Canary have all been good reads." A couple of other comments. 1. Thanks for dropping the knowledge on the other band names. Wouldn't have put that together despite reading the early stories in the archive. That's why this is the place for Canary fans. Hey, happy to be of help. 2. Convinced the White Ninja is going to be Dinah's mother. This would add a classic wrinkle of generations of martial artists in the family. The blood sample will be to confirm the relationship. That crossed my mind and I kind of dismissed it, but I have started thinking about it a little bit more, and if that's the case, I think I can dig it. We really don't know Dinah's mother in the new continuity, so they would have to craft her from scratch, but if they can play up the angle that she's still a legacy hero, I kind of like that idea. We'll see how it goes. 3. We heard so much about the record deal in this issue, especially how it was a one-disc, one-tour deal, makes me wonder if the whole music angle will disappear once the current mega arc is done. Yeah, that's sort of the impression that I've got. It's kind of what Brendan Fletcher has mentioned, that Black Canary as a band concept will probably wrap up around issue 4. It might continue to be part of her civilian identity, maybe, but I think she's going to go into more conventional superhero stories, a little bit more what we're used to from Black Canary after issue 12. And 4, Ange says, I don't trust the manager. Yeah, me neither. The next comment comes from Craig McDonald. I think this issue was an okay read, but not great. Yes, it asked some important questions, but I feel like those were questions that, at least the readers, had already been asking in the first 4 issues. This issue didn't really seem to move the overall storyline forward. I know the first trade of the series collects issues 1-7, so it will be interesting to see how many things get wrapped up in the next issues. I'm guessing we'll get a battle with Beau Maeve, but the secrets of Ditto and the White Canary Ninja might not get revealed for a few more issues yet. Yeah, I think in the next 2 issues we'll get our battle with Beau Maeve, and we might see a resolution to Ditto, or we might get some answers about her. But Brendan Fletcher told me that the White Ninja will be the second story arc, and that will come out after issue 7. And moving on to episode 19, in which Chris Franklin from the Supermates podcast helped me cover The Brave and the Bold issues 61 and 62, we got a few more comments. The first one, again, from Dr. Ange. I first learned the name Murphy Anderson from Secret Origins and Who's Who, impressed by his precise, fine-lined work. His Who's Who pages from the Quality Heroes made me interested in folks like the Ray, etc. Later, as I began to get back issues, I acquired a ton of the Swanderson Superman books, including the Kryptonite Nevermore story, one of my all-time favorites. It was then that I discovered how well he meshed with Kurt Swan. I had the luck of meeting him at a very little Comic-Con in Boston in the early 2000s, before the Boston Comic-Con was even around. He was a perfect representation of that era. He was in a suit and tie, he had his wife at his table, and he was a perfect gentleman. He answered some questions I had and signed my Superman 233. Thanks for this retrospective. Rob Kelly from the Aquaman Shrine and the Fire and Water podcast said, "Great episode, fellas. The first true comic shop I ever visited was called El Dorado Comics, a few minutes from my house. When I got there, I was simply amazed at how many old comics there were to look through. It was a wonderland. I tried to buy as many of the old comics as I could with the few bucks that I had, and one of the first back issues I ever bought was Brave and the Bold 61. Not sure why, probably it was in terrible condition, therefore cheap, but I remember loving it because it seemed like such a portal to comics history that I was, at the time, completely unfamiliar with. Good tribute to Anderson, he did tremendous work on these stories, and Robinson using them as a basis for the plot decades later I also thought was clever and cool." Martin Gray from the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl said, "Wonderful show honoring a wonderful artist. I loved Murphy Anderson's super clean, imaginative work. What a craftsman. I think, though, that you accidentally overstated how long Swanderson went for. It was pretty much a 1971 through 1973 deal. It certainly didn't reach the 80s. I guess I must have been confused when I was looking at their partnership and their long careers thinking that they had worked together for longer. Martin says, "These showcase issues sound, as Shag would put it, boss, though the tautology of Girl Gladiatrix is unforgivable. That's almost as upsetting as the Affair retcon. So icky." And finally, we've got a comment from Kyle Benning from the King Size Comics Giant Size Fun podcast, which now includes Turtle Tuesdays and Star Wars Saturdays. "Awesome episode, fellas. As much as it pains me to say, since I've had the joy of podcasting with Ryan on 9 episodes now, I think Chris makes the perfect co-host. You guys have a great dynamic and play off each other really well and had some great critical analysis of these stories. Chris might have to warn Cindy she has some competition on the podcasting partner front. I'm sure Shag would be available to fill in on Supermates as in Chris's absence." Nice. Well, I can't speak to Shag and Cindy working together, but Chris and I will definitely be partnering up on some other projects in the future. Kyle continues, onto the issues you gents covered. I love these things. Man, there is just so much love from this era of DC in the Showcase, Mystery in Space, Strange Adventures, and Brave and the Bold titles. I don't think it's any coincidence that Murphy Anderson was cranking out art on these popular titles. His impact and revolutionary page compositions really moved DC forward in their sequential storytelling. I think Anderson, Kubert, and Infantino are really the three main guys responsible for moving DC out of the six-panel grid page layout that was the house style of DC in the 50s up through the mid-60s in some titles. Whatever holdouts to that more boring or tame six-grade layout were then smashed when Neil Adams came into prominence at DC. Fantastic episode. Well, thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Ange. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, everybody who has continued to support Flowers and Fishnets, a Black Canary podcast. That is going to do it for this episode. Remember, leave a comment on the blog page for this episode or mention it on Twitter for your chance to win a free copy of Black Canary and Zatanna Bloodspell. If you enjoyed the show, you can leave a comment on the blogger page, blackcanaryfan.blogspot.com. There you can contact me with any questions or comments. You can also find me on Facebook and on Twitter using the handle @blackcanaryfan or @RyanDaily01. Flowers and Fishnets is not affiliated with DC Comics, and the views expressed on the show belong solely to the speaker. All music, audio clips, and quoted text are used for entertainment purposes and are believed covered under fair use. And since I make no money off this podcast, no copyright infringement is intended. Thanks for listening, and remember, Supergirl or Jessica Jones, you can only have one.